Hi, I'm Daniel Lukic.
And this is Mick, the Doctor of Digital.
And welcome to Music 101. Music 101 is created to empower music itself, and legendary icon in the music industry. Another week, another great episode. Alchemist of Rock, the greatest backing bands of the 1960s and 70s, part one.
Yes, indeed. So, you know, every era has its myths of the lone genius, a solitary figure at the microphone, the master guitarist alone in the spotlight, the songwriter who changed the world one chord at a time. But rock and roll, at its most elemental, has always been a team sport. Behind every iconic frontman or woman who defined the sonic landscape of the 1960s and 70s stands a constellation of musicians, sometimes unnamed, sometimes undersung, often misunderstood, whose collective intelligence shaped the very recordings we hold sacred. In conclusion, this episode of Music 101 pulls back the curtain on that hidden architecture, the famous backing bands who didn't just support the stars they played beside, but in many cases became the stars, transforming raw talent into something lasting, luminous, and almost impossibly great.
Mr. Mink, when we talk about backing bands, what we're really talking about, are we just talking about, well, hired musicians, Guns of Fire, or is there something deeper happening?
That's exactly the right place to start, because the term backing band can be misleading if we're not careful. In the most literal sense, yes, a backing band is a group of musicians assembled, sometimes permanently, sometimes informally, to support a named solo artist. They play your chord changes, keep your time, fill your arrangements. But in the period we're talking about, the late 1960s through the 1970s, something more interesting was happening. In many of the best cases, the relationship between the frontman and the band was alchemical. The frontman provided the vision, the songs, the persona, the commercial engine, while the band provided the actual musical character. Without the band, the frontman might have been good. With the right band, they became historic. There are early examples of that dynamic. Let's go back to one of the most storied moments in all of rock history, Bob Dylan going electric. Now, Dylan had been the reigning poet of folk music through the early 1960s, but by 1965, he had reached a creative fork in the road. He wanted to make music that was louder, more rhythmically driven, more viscerally alive. He needed a band that would hold the electric surge without losing the lyrical density that made him Dylan. And the band he found, a group of young Canadians plus one Arkansas drummer who had been working the club circuit as the Hawks, the backing band for rockabilly singer Ronnie Hawkins, turned out to be exactly the outfit he needed. When Dylan walked onto the stage at the 1965 Newport Folk Festival with an electric guitar in his new band, the folk purists famously booed. One audience member at a 1966 concert in Manchester, England, screamed "Judas" at Dylan from the crowd. But Dylan looked at his band, reportedly cursing, said, "Play it loud," and they launched into "Like a Rolling Stone" with everything they had. That moment didn't just divide audiences, it changed music forever, and it could not have happened without a band good enough to match Dylan's courage. And those same musicians eventually became the band. After Dylan was injured in his motorcycle accident in July 1966 and withdrew from public life, his backing group rented a house in West Saugerties, New York, a modest pink structure that became known simply as Big Pink, and began writing their own music. Dylan came by in the evenings, and together they recorded an enormous cache of informal songs that were eventually released in 1975 as the Basement Tapes. But the real revelation came in 1968, when Capitol Records released music from Big Pink, the debut album of the group now called The Band. The members, guitarist Robbie Robertson, pianist Richard Manuel, bassist Rich Danko, organist and multi-instrumentalist Garth Hudson, and drummer Levon Helm, had become so thoroughly described as Dylan's band by their manager and others that the band became both a private joke and a badge of identity. As Helm later told the story, when a backstage guard asked who they were before a January 1968 Carnegie Hall tribute to Woody Guthrie, Helm shot back, "The Crackers," a dry, self-depreciating punchline. But their record label vetoed that name, and the band it was. Music from Big Pink is special. Everything about it goes against the grain of the moment. This was 1968, the peak of psychedelia, the year of the Cream's triple supergroup Guitar Excess and the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper Hangover. And here came a record that sounded like it was made in a church basement in 1930. It drew on gospel, Appalachian folk, country blues, and soul in equal measure, with Robbie Robertson's economical guitar sitting back in the mix alongside Garth Hudson's Baroque organ voicings and the interweaving vocals of Helm, Manuel, and Danko. Pink Floyd's Roger Waters later called it the second most influential record in the history of rock and roll. Eric Clapton, who was then at the peak of his commercial fame with Cream, heard music from Big Pink and was so shaken by it that he dissolved Cream and walked away. He called it, in a 1992 concert, "Something That Changed My Life." The Wait is the album's most beloved song, a mysterious, slightly surreal narrative saturated in biblical imagery and Southern Gothic texture, sung with Levon Helm's impossibly warm and gritty voice. It also appeared to enormous cultural effect in the 1969 film Easy Rider, which introduced the band to a generation of young Americans who might never have found them otherwise. So what we're really seeing is a backing band that transcended the category entirely. The band became one of the defining American groups of their era, even though four of the five members were Canadian, which in itself is a beautiful irony. Their entire artistic premise was to capture the spirit of American roots music more authentically than most Americans could manage. And the reason the relationship with Dylan worked so well, both then and later, was that they rejoined for their celebrated 1974 tour and magnificent concert film, The Last Waltz. Is that Dylan's verbal restlessness and the band's musical depth were genuinely complementary. Neither was sufficient without the other. And that's what a great backing band does. At its highest, it completes the equation. In conclusion, the story of the band illustrates the core truth that the greatest backing groups weren't simply accompanists, but creative partners who transformed a frontman's vision into something larger, stranger, and more enduring than either could have achieved alone.
Very well said, Mr. Mick. And you mentioned Eric Clapton disbanding Cream after hearing music from a Big Pink. Did the same philosophy of stripping things back find expression in other great backing bands of the era?
It certainly did, and the most compelling parallel case is Crazy Horse, the band that became the primary musical vehicle for Neil Young beginning in 1969. The story of Crazy Horse is really the story of Danny Whitten, one of the great unsung guitarists in rock history, and a man whose personal tragedy would haunt Neil Young for the rest of his career. Young encountered the musicians who would become Crazy Horse in August 1968. When they were performing a residency as the Rockets at the Whiskey A Go-Go on the Sunset Strip in Los Angeles. Danny Whitten played guitar, Billy Talbot played bass, Ralph Molina played drums, and the three of them had a long backstory together. They'd come up from a doo-wop group called Danny and the Memories, moving through the club circuit before landing in the Rockets. Young was immediately drawn to Whitten's playing. He had what Young would later describe as almost telepathic second guitar sense, an instinctive ability to find the counterpoint to whatever Young was doing without ever cluttering the picture. Young poached the three of them from the Rockets, renamed them Crazy Horse, and took them into the studio in January 1969. And the result was Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere. Released in May 1969, one of the most important albums in the history of rock music and the foundation of what Young called his shaky sound, a deliberately rough-edged, high-volume approach that valued feeling and spontaneity over precision. The entire album was reportedly written in a feverish afternoon when Young was sick in bed and recorded in just 2 weeks. The three centerpiece songs, Cinnamon Girl, Down by the River, and Cowgirl in the Sand, together span nearly half an hour of music, which extended guitar interplay between Young and Whitten that has never quite been matched for its mix of directness and mystery. Whitten's rhythm parts, Young later said, were the key to everything, loose and ever-shifting, always in the groove but never predictable, leading the other players from one pocket to the next without ever announcing the move. But what happened to Danny Whitten is one of the sadder stories in rock history. Whitten developed a severe heroin addiction in the early 1970s, and by the time Young was assembling the musicians for his Tonight's the Night sessions in late 1972, Witten's playing had deteriorated to the point that Young felt he couldn't include him. According to Young's own accounts, he gave Witten $50 and sent him home. Danny Witten died of a heroin overdose that same night, on November 18, 1972. He was 29. Tonight's the Night became Young's rawest, most grief-stricken album and record made in a kind of sustained, deliberate mourning. And the song, The Needle and the Damage Done, stands as one of rock music's most plain-spoken elegies for a gifted life consumed by addiction. And yet Crazy Horse continued beyond Witten. They did, with subsequent members, most notably guitarist Frank Pancho Sampedro, joining in the mid-1970s and carrying the band forward through Rust Never Sleeps and beyond. But the spirit of Crazy Horse as a musical concept was established in those early Witten recordings, a kind of organized chaos, a controlled noise, a willingness to sit in a single chord for what felt like a geological epoch of time while Young's guitar found its way through something vast and formless. Like a Hurricane from the 1977 album American Stars and Bars, one of the great guitar performances on record, would be unthinkable without a band capable of that particular brand of patience and surrender. In conclusion, Crazy Horse demonstrated that the most powerful backing band is not necessarily the most technically accomplished one, but rather the one most attuned to its frontman's specific emotional frequency, a lesson every musician on this list found their own way of learning.
Indeed, some make we've been thinking about bands rooted in American or Americana and roots music, but the 1970s also gave us something very different. Glam rock, a theatrical express a total reinvention of the performing self, and no story capture the better than David Bowie and Spiders from Mars.
And what makes the Spiders from Mars such a fascinating case study is that they were simultaneously one of the most technically accomplished backing bands of the era and one of the most undervalued. Guitarist Mick Ronson, bassist Trevor Boulder, and drummer Mick Woody Woodmansey had all come out of Hull, Yorkshire music scene, about as far from the glamour of London as you could imagine. And they had a particularly Northern English directness and solidity that served as the perfect counterweight to Bowie's mercurial, theatrical ambitions. Ronson in particular was a musician of extraordinary breadth, a classically influenced arranger who could write lush string parts and deliver savage rock guitar with equal fluency. The roots of the Spiders came together and go back to 1970, when Bowie was looking for a new backing group for the album that became The Man Who Sold the World. He was introduced to Ronson, who was literally marking out a rugby pitch for Hull City Council at the time, having failed to make it in London, by drummer John Cambridge, and Ronson joined immediately. Woodmansey came on around the same time, and Boulder eventually replaced producer Tony Visconti on bass in 1971 during the Hunky Dory sessions. Though they weren't yet officially named, these three formed the core of what would become the Spiders from Mars. The name itself came from Bowie's creation of his alter ego, Ziggy Stardust, an androgynous alien rock messiah, a figure inspired in part by the real-life British rockabilly singer Vince Taylor, who had descended into believing himself to be the son of God while performing on stage. And the album that launched everything was The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, released in June 1972. One of the towering achievements of the decade, recorded in less than 3 weeks at Trident Studios in London in late 1971, mostly in first takes, according to engineer Ken Scott, who once recalled that Bowie's vocal performances recorded live at a rate that would astonish modern producers. The album is a loose rock opera about the rise and fall of Ziggy, a young man who channels alien messages through music, becomes worship, and is destroyed by his own fame. It's both a commercial pop record and a profound meditation on the nature of celebrity and artifice. But none of it would have landed without Ronson's contributions. Listen to the opening guitar figure of Hang On To Yourself, a proto-punk, snarling, propulsive, or the aching orchestral grandeur of Starman, where Ronson's string arrangements give the song its sense of cosmic possibility. Bowie himself said of Ronson they were, as a performing duo, every bit as good as Mick, Keith, or Axl or Slash. At the yin and yang dynamic between Ziggy's fluid sexuality and Ronson's blunt northern masculinity was the essence of what made the project work. Brunson went on to do other significant work. Here's a detail that at times is unappreciated by rock fans. Mick Ronson co-produced and played on Lou Reed's Transformer in 1972 alongside Bowie, and his string arrangements are central to Perfect Day and Satellite of Love. He was also present at a pivotal moment for Mott the Hoople, a band we'll return to in some depth, in 1972. It was Bowie and Ronson who produced Mott's album All the Young Dudes, and Ronson contributed a beautiful string arrangement to the track Sea Diver. After Bowie retired the Ziggy persona at the Hammersmith Odeon in July 1973, famously, and with little warning to his bandmates, the Spiders fractured. Boulder and Woodmansee continued under the Spiders' name for one largely forgotten album in 1976, but Ronson went on to become one of the most valuable collaborators in rock history, working extensively with Ian Hunter through the late 70s and 80s, a partnership we'll discuss in depth later. He died of liver cancer in April 1993 at just 46. Bowie, who died of the same disease, said simply, "There was something special about Mick." In conclusion, the Spiders from Mars exemplify how a backing band can become inseparable from a frontman's greatest creative statement, so much so that when the band dissolved, the artistic achievement it had enabled could never be fully replicated.
Well said, Mr. Mick. So we've been looking at bands defined by kind of grandeur. The band's American mythology, Crazy Horse's mysticism, and the Spider theatrical spectacle. But there's another stand of great backing bands from the era that come out something much smaller and scrappier, the British pop rock scene.
And the finest product of that scene is almost certainly Graham Parker and The Rumour, one of the most criminally underappreciated frontman and band combinations of the 1970s. Graham Parker was a 24-year-old petrol pump attendant from Surrey, England, in the spring of 1975. He had zero professional music experience. What he had was a stack of extraordinary songs, fierce, intelligent, R&B drenched, lyrically unsparing, and the tenacity to place an advert in Melody Maker seeking musicians. Through a chain of introductions, he was eventually steered toward Dave Robinson, who had managed the defunct punk rock band Brinsley Schwartz. Robinson had a small studio above the Hoke and Anchor pub in Islington, and he immediately recognized what he had in Parker. And the musicians Robinson brought in came directly from that pub rock world, from several branches of it, which is what made The Rumour so extraordinary. Guitarist Brinsley Schwartz, yes, there really was a person named Brinsley Schwartz and the band named Brinsley Schwartz, and keyboardist Bob Andrews came from the Brinsley Schwartz band. Rhythm guitarist Martin Belmont came from the Dux Deluxe. Bassist Andrew Bodnar and drummer Steve Goulding came from Bon Ton Roulet. They were seasoned touring musicians bordered and hardened by the web pop rock circuit, and when Parker's songs hit them, it was, as Schwartz later described, like a fire being lit under them. Parker's words and aggression, Schwartz said, brought out the best in all of them. The band even took their name from a song by the band, though using the English spelling, which tells you something about where their aesthetic allegiances lie. Their debut album, Howling Wind, came out in April 1976, and it was a critical sensation. Produced by Nick Lowe, who had been the bass player and singer in the Brinsley Schwartz band, and who described the experience of producing his old bandmates with a new frontman as genuinely odd, but creatively liberating. Howling Wind was recorded at Eden Studios in London, and it placed fourth in the Village Voice's prestigious Jazz and Pop Critics poll for 1976. Which was remarkable given that Parker was then an entirely unknown quantity. Critics heard a fury and intelligence that recalled Van Morrison at his most unhinged, but with a punkish urgency that placed it squarely in the moment. Don't Ask Me Questions, a reggae-tinged dismissal of a malevolent god, became Parker's early signature. Later the same year, they released Heat Treatment, their second album, and it placed second in the same critics' poll behind only Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life. Two albums in 1 year, both in the top five of the year's critical consensus. That is an extraordinary achievement for a man who had been pumping petrol 12 months earlier. They never quite broke through commercially, though, and it's one of the great injustices in rock history. Part of the problem was timing. Punk broke in 1977, and the music press, which had been championing Parker as the next big thing, pivoted almost overnight to the Sex Pistols and the Clash. Parker and the Rumor found themselves stranded between categories, too angry and raw for the mainstream, too musically accomplished and song-oriented to be punk. Their masterwork, 1979's Squeezing Out Sparks, which stripped away the horn section that had been a feature of earlier albums and left a leaner, more concentrated sound, is routinely cited as one of the great albums of the era. Rolling Stone placed it at number 335 in their 500 greatest albums of all time. The track, Passion is No Ordinary Word, shows what the Rumor could do when given room to breathe. A slow-building, emotionally devastating piece of music that demonstrates the full depth of their ensemble playing. In conclusion, Graham Parker and the Rumor offer a cautionary tale about the relationship between commercial success and artistic achievement, proving that a backing band of real consequences can elevate a frontman to greatness even when the world is too distracted to fully notice.
Well, that is interesting, Mr. Mick. And to wrap up with a subject of one-year books, one track, Ian Hunter, who some of our listeners may know primarily as the frontman of Matt the Hoople, but his solo career, especially his collaboration with Mick Ronson. Is it a story we have not told fully yet?
And it's a story that deserves its own chapter, because what Hunter and Ronson built together in the late 1970s stands as one of the great creative partnerships in rock. Mott the Hoople were one of the key British bands of the early 70s and 80s, a hard rock with literary pretensions, fronted by Ian Hunter in dark glasses and a lion's mane of curly black hair, writing songs that took teenagers seriously as cultural subjects. David Bowie, who was a genuine fan, gave Mott the song All the Young Dudes in 1972, essentially saving a band that had been on the brink of disbanding, and also producing the album of the same name, on which Ronson arranged the strings for Sea Diver. The Mott album of 1973 was another high-water mark, with All the Way from Memphis, a magnificent account of life on the rock and roll road, with the indignity and grandeur of being a working musician in an era that promised everything and delivered so much uncertainty. Hunter left Mott in 1974, and his debut solo album, Ian Hunter, came out in 1975. Once Bitten, Twice Shy became his first genuine solo hit, a hard-driving account of a young woman losing her innocence to rock and roll's glamour and betrayal. Ronson was on the album, and their partnership, Ronson's riffs, richly melodic guitar work against Hunter's gravelly, emotionally honest voice, proved so natural that it deepened through subsequent years. By 1979, after a couple of albums that hadn't quite found their footing, Hunter made the record that many serious admirers consider his masterpiece, You're Never Alone with a Schizophrenic, released on Chrysalis Records. The title, wonderfully, came from a phrase Ronson spotted written on a bathroom wall. It was, as Hunter has noted, medically inaccurate. Schizophrenia has nothing to do with multiple personality disorder, but as a rock and roll album title, it was pitch perfect. And the backing musicians on that album are a remarkable story in themselves. Hunter and Ronson recorded the album at the Power Station in Manhattan, engineered by Bob Clearmountain, who would go on to mix Born in the USA and dozens of other landmark records, with three members of Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, pianist Roy Bittan, drummer Max Weinberg, and bassist Gary Tallent. The combination of Ronson's British Hall rock sensibility and the E Street Band's epic American thrust produced something genuinely unlike anything else, a record that feels both intimate and cinematic, both confessional and anthem-ready. Let's consider some of the songs, because the lyrics Hunter wrote for this album are exceptional. The opening track, Just Another Night, co-written with Ronson, is an entertaining saga of mouthing off to the boys in blue, losing the battle after a bad encounter with authority, the narrator confronting institutional power with a mixture of outrage and dark humor. The lyric, You Ain't Gotta Touch a Man to Make a Man Bleed, is one of Hunter's finest lines, a compact moral observation that lands like a punch. Then there's Cleveland Rocks, which became Hunter's most famous American anthem, a furious, funny celebration of mid-American working-class energy, built on a stuttering guitar riff and Weinberg's pistol-shot snare. The song was later transformed into the theme for the Drew Carey Show in a 1997 version by the Presidents of the United States of America, which raised Hunter's American profile considerably. The album also contains Ships, which is one of his most emotionally direct ballads. Ships is a meditation on the distance between Hunter's father and himself. Two people who love each other but have lived parallel, never converging lives. The lyrics state, "We only read you when you write." The image Hunter uses is the old cliche of ships passing in the night. And he's honest about the fact that it is a cliche, but he gives it such emotional weight. The lyric, "We sat and watched the distant lights," captures the specific quality of that wordless grief between parents and adult children, that it transcends its own sentimentality. Hunter apparently had mixed feelings about the song, thinking he'd aimed too obviously for a commercial ballad. But Barry Manilow covered it, took it to number 9 in the Billboard chart, and it became one of Hunter's most reliable royalty earners. Ronson himself ended up singing much of the closing track, "When the Daylight Comes," apparently because Ronson genuinely loved the song while Hunter remained ambivalent about it. And then, of course, there is "Bastard." That's a much more caustic piece of writing. Hunter refers it to as a true love story. He means what really happens in relationships. It is one of the great rock songs about a specific kind of emotional torment. The person who draws you in with a particular brand of chaos, who controls you through the pleasure of their own unpredictability. The imagery is extravagant, but it's also precise in its psychology. Hunter has described it as a song that came out of real experience, which performs its edge of genuine exasperation. Ronson's guitar on this track is extraordinary, a raw, somewhat brutal figure that perfectly mirrors the lyrics' mood of helpless, furious entrapment. In conclusion, the Hunter-Ronson partnership is proof that a great backing musician, one who is genuinely an equal creative partner rather than a hired hand, can give a frontman a second wind powerful enough to define their legacy.
Well said, and thank you for those legacy indeed. The unsung heroes behind many rock's greatest masterpieces were not always the lead singers or headlines acts, but as extraordinary backing bands whose talent transform good songs into a timeless classic. So, Mr. Mick, would you like to plug in something?
Oh, I appreciate the opportunity. Write the book, grow the business, connect with me on LinkedIn. G. Mick, the Doctor of Digital Smith, PhD, listen to the Doctor of Digital podcast, listen to pick up a couple volumes I have on Amazon, On Track, Ian Hunter, and Burning America. And if you support music, support true fans.
Indeed, let's support Mr. Mick, the Doctor of Digital, and please do listen to all the 4 podcasts that we are creating with Mr. Mick every week, and please visit our official website, www.universalpodcast.net, Music 101, of course, Sex 101, Mental Health 101, and Love Letters. So, Mr. Mick, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, my friend. Till next time, Deus vult.
Morning, people. See you soon.